I'm Rachel Wiseman from the Texas Department of State Health Services, and we looked at sort of the lab side of sort of a similar situation as happened in Colorado, and I'm going to go through those, the study here. So just sort of the requisite incident slide. In the 80s and 90s, Texas enjoyed a relatively low incidence of pertussis. However, since about 2000, it has been steadily increasing. We still see the 3 to 5 year cycles that are common in pertussis. However, the peaks are increasing every year or every cycle, and the valleys are also increasing. It peaked in 09 at over 3,300 cases, which is the highest we've had since 1952. And in 2010, it's slightly lower, just under 3,000. But obviously, we'd like to see that much lower. So, and notably, these cases are probably about 60 to 70% of them are from three counties in the state, which happen to be also the three counties where some of these issues were discovered. So just a little bit of background on how we got into this situation. Private providers noted that they were suddenly receiving a lot of positive PCR results for pertussis. The PCR-positive patients that they were concerned about had either an inconsistent clinical presentation, generally a very short cough duration, or in one particular clinic, they had had a recent pertussis diagnosis and successful treatment, generally with a positive PCR. So within a span of 6 to 9 months, they'd had two positive PCR test results with antibiotic treatment in between, and this was considered very suspicious. And these were in two distinct regions of Texas. However, they were in some of our highest burden areas. And all the clinicians used the same lab, Lab A. We should have coordinated on the title. And just a little bit of background on PCR. There is no FDA-approved PCR test. Every lab validates its own cutoff values. And SEMA discussed a lot of this. But the lower the cycle times, the more DNA there is, and the higher, the less DNA. Which can be a low disease burden. Either a patient is receiving treatment or is at sort of the end of the infectious period or possibly contamination. So a little bit about the media for transportation for PCR. Lab A uses a liquid transport media, and then, again, the liquid, not the swab, is tested. The Texas State Laboratory uses no media for transportation, and then, of course, the swab has to be tested. There's nothing else available. So some previous studies on this area, a lot of this has been highlighted. Vaccines can have pertussis DNA detectable by PCR. Clinical environments have had DNA detected by PCR. And we were aware of the study that had already happened in Durango. And so we were suspicious of the liquid media issue from the get-go. So we did a brief environmental sample, which I'm just going to go through real quick and then get to the good laboratory part. Our health department went out and visited one of the clinics that had high positive PCR rate, and we swabbed patients' rooms, nurses' station, vaccine handling areas, and those samples were tested by our state laboratory using their standard PCR methods. 17 samples were collected, and one was found to be positive for pertussis DNA, and it happened to be an exam room door handle. So the bulk of our study, however, was on laboratory comparison. In the first phase, we had two clinics collect dual NP swabs on patients presenting with pertussis-like symptoms, and then parallel testing was performed by Laboratory A and the state laboratory, and then sort of an ad hoc second phase was added on by our laboratory that really got excited and on some of these results, and the labs traded 10 patient samples for retesting. So just to get right into the results, 64 patients had samples collected. All were tested. So these are the exact same patients at each laboratory. The state labs, those results are easier, had 63 not detected results, negative results, and one parapertussis. Lab A had 28 not detected, which is 44% compared to our 98%, 16 positive results, 19 equivocal results, and then that same parapertussis. So the parapertussis was a success. But that's a discrepancy of 54.7%. And this actually Within the first batch of specimens, we knew we had a problem because immediately the discrepancy was just huge. We had actually done some calculations on how many samples we would need, and we were able to cut it off much sooner because the discrepancy came out very quickly. So just to go into the equivocal issue a little bit, this was something that was unknown to us on the surveillance side, but when we, you know, equivocal results are not necessarily reported by laboratories, they're not positive results. And so suddenly we had, you know, 30% of these results coming in were equivocal, and there were calls from the providers, calls to the lab. And so this really ties into some of those cycle times we went into. And you can see our laboratory uses a different cutoff value. Anything that has less than 35 cycles is positive, whereas Lab A uses less than 40. And then our, we call it indeterminate in Texas, is their range is 35 to 39, which would be positive in the private lab. So some of this may be some things that we're calling negative, they're calling equivocal. It may just be a reflection of where the cutoffs are set for the different tests. So then, as I said, the two labs traded samples, and this gets a little complicated to follow, but so the first column is what Lab A got when the sample originally was sent to them from the clinic, and then that parallel specimen went to our lab. So then, you know, the third column here is when the state lab, the Texas lab, sent our specimen that we had already tested, sent it to the private lab, who then retested it. So they were able to validate our results, most likely because there was no DNA there to be found. However, they couldn't validate the results they'd gotten when they tested the first sample on this patient. And then when Lab A sent their samples to us, we couldn't quite validate their results or our results either. And that may tie into the cycle time cutoffs because those first two, patient one and patient two, would be negative in our lab. However, they did have a cycle time that sort of chimed off above 39, which may have been equivocal or positive in their lab. And the same for patient three would have been indeterminate in our lab with a 35 cycle time value, but it's positive at theirs. So we really took these results to mean that if there's a small amount of DNA in a patient sample, either from contamination or possibly a patient that's been treated or has, you know, been coughing for several weeks already, the fact that there's no media to, you know, take that one little DNA that's sitting on the stick that's been put in the tube, you know, the DNA can't walk from the stick to the swab that's being tested at our lab. However, if it's stuck into liquid media, that liquid media is going to touch everything in there, and then that's what's going to get tested. And so that, you know, one little DNA that's sitting out there is not going to be picked up by the state lab. However, it may be picked up by this private lab because of their use of liquid media. So this was really concerning to us, and you know, the cutoff values are a concern to us because of the large amount of equivocals, and the providers call us and ask, what do we do with these? They don't call the laboratory and say, what do we do with these? So what we did in Texas was we wrote this up in a brief summary, outlined the study results, and we made several recommendations to our providers and health departments that we wanted them to separate their vaccine handling area so that any contamination from the vaccine, you know, that they weren't mixing them in clinic rooms or in the nurse's station where the charts are and the computers and everything, that they needed to decontaminate all their surface areas, that if they needed to glove for NP swabbing, and that they needed to use new gloves. So if they had the gloves on to do the vaccine or do whatever, and you know they've gotten them contaminated, and then they're holding the swab, well, that's not the point. That you know you're just spreading the DNA around. And then to not handle swabs below the break point for the liquid media. So a lot of them there are snapped in two. Shortly after that, the CDC issued best practices for PCR for pertussis, which is here. And it a lot of it had the same recommendations that we had made. I did find myself in sort of an ethical dilemma in that a lot of people wanted to say who the laboratory was or to say, Texas says do not use liquid media. However, our state laboratory provides the service and they charge for it. And so there's sort of a conflict of interest of, you know, I could just say don't use that, use our lab, and it would be profit generating for the state of Texas. So that was, we had an issue there in trying to make sure we use very specific language to not, shift business around inappropriately. And then there, the reason these false positives are concerning is, a lot of these occurred in high endemic areas for Texas, and so it does beg the question of how much of what we're seeing as pertussis burden in Texas is actual cases. And these are areas that we've actually not been able to get the numbers to come down. They've just become endemic, and now we're really wondering, well, is it because of these false positive results? And there are a lot of things that happen once a positive result comes to the state health department or to the local health department or to the clinician's office. Well, if it's a child, they're kept out of school for 5 days. It means mom has to stay home for 5 days. If it's an adult, they have to stay out of work for 5 days. It's unnecessary antibiotic treatment, not only for the patient, but then all of their contacts. That can often expand to an entire daycare or to an entire classroom. It's a lot of work for a health department and for a school if it's a child that's diagnosed. The school nurses are the front line for pertussis, and they do a lot of investigation, a lot of contacting, a lot of, your child can't come to school today or your child has to go home, and a lot of collaboration with the health department. And the health department has to do all these investigations and track every coughing contact. And, well, in Cedar season in Austin, everyone is coughing, and so one positive result and you're suddenly interviewing 20 families. It can create an outbreak situation, which it is problematic in that it's, again, resources, but it also creates worry in the community, and we've seen that in these endemic areas that one coughing child sends the school into a panic, sends the clinical environment into a panic, parents in a panic, we have created this cycle of just a child walks into a doctor's office coughing and they get a PCR test for pertussis, and it's just we've been unable to break that, and we are just generating investigation after investigation for our health departments. And when some of the results are coming back positive, it's validating what the clinician is doing and seeing when maybe we don't really have an issue. And the clinical picture of pertussis is distorted if you're testing children inappropriately, but then the result comes back positive. Well, now you've just affirmed that, well, what I just saw is pertussis, so I'm going to test all the children that look like this, and you may be missing all the children that actually have pertussis. And the true burden of pertussis becomes unknown, which at the state level is a big dilemma for me because I have to answer why we have such high case rates that aren't coming down, and I can't say, well, I don't think it's really that high. Leave me alone, but I don't really think it's that high, but I also can't quantify that. So thank you very much.